Louder?
Louder.
Louder. Does everybody hear me? Well, I don't have to give the presentation. I only have to introduce the speakers. So as everybody sort of gets settled, I'll mention, I think this is going to be my favorite session all along, because those that know me, and I'm Steve Ram, by the way, as listed in your program. As most people know me, I really like the early materials, and today's a perfect day to have this session, because we're going to end off this afternoon talking about historic recordings, and we start tomorrow morning with what sounds like it's going to be an incredible, almost part two of what we're doing this afternoon, with the First Sounds Initiative and some very rare Edison recordings. If you watched the news this morning, you heard that the First Sounds has now found before Edison, the earliest sound recording. And if not, ask somebody else, they'll tell you about it after the session. But we're gonna start off this afternoon with Before Sousa. When I think of band recordings, my early band recordings, they usually are Sousas, but I think I'm gonna learn a lot, and you will also, from Dan Reed, who's going to be presenting Before Sousa, the Patrick Gilmore story. Dan's been a professional music educator. He's got his master's in education. He's been an educator for 29 years and hasn't gotten to the point yet where he's stopped giving the number of how many years he's been an educator. We tend to do that after a while. And he's taught at all levels from pre-kindergarten through the adult area. Trained musician, he plays trumpet. He's also a master teacher and an active clinician. He researches early, and what he determines early as 1865 to 1932, concert and military bands. Obviously, the 1865 recording bands were not recording in those days, although we may find that out today, too. Their recordings, programs, and music. He lectures and writes extensively on these subjects. He's also a private collector. He collects ephemera from the golden age of the band, and he is the president emeritus of the California Antique Phonograph Society. He last appeared before ARSC in 2002 when we came to Santa Barbara, and the California Antique Phonograph Society Southwest Museum did a presentation on early cylinder recordings of the Charles Loomis collection of, if I seem to remember, were American Indian recordings. Anyway, I now present you Dan Reed.
Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen, and thank you for having me here. Thank you, Steve. If I have any extra time, I want you to tell that postcard story. There are going to be two words today that I want you to learn. The first word is big, and the other word is anvil. As Steve indicated, I'm a music teacher. Currently, I teach elementary kids band and orchestra, and it's a very rewarding job. But as Art Linkletter would say, kids say the darndest things. And let me give you an example. In band, I have a girl, and her name is Emily, and she's one of those talkers. If she'd practice as much as she talks, she'd be with the LA Philharmonic by now. Out of the blue one day, she says, "Mr. Reed, why is the hair on your chin gray and on top of your head is brown?" Oh, you know these little pistols, you know? But I'm one step ahead of them, okay? So I answer, "It's because of all those wrong notes you played, okay? You're right below me. You play them, they hit my chin first, it turns the hair gray. That's why." Clever, right? Now, without missing a beat, she turns to the others and says, "Okay, you guys, let's get with it, or he'll be gray by Christmas." And Christmas is where we begin. Gilmore was born on December 25th, Christmas Day, 1829, in Ballygar, County Galway, in Ireland. He studied at the local school. He had a just normal childhood during that time period. His parents, the town was so small that his parents were really kind of forced to go into the largest market town in Athlone. Now, in 1843, he saw the great liberator, Daniel O'Connell hold one of his monster rallies. Now, this guy was really about Irish independence, okay? And he would hold these just magnificently sized rallies. Now, this rally had 200,000 people in it. Now, if you can imagine spread out in the countryside, 200,000 people listening to one man speak, and he could hold their attention, Gilmore never forgot this. Although his parents wanted him to go into the priesthood at 16, they bought him an apprentice at Fallon's Brewery. Great place for a musician, wouldn't you say?
Excuse me, could you use a mic? A microphone?
Okay, so I'll speak up, right? Okay, can you hear me now?
Yeah.
Okay, Verizon, here we go. That's a little too loud. How about now? Everybody got me now?
Yeah.
Okay, great. Now, even though he would sing in church and he would play this little tin whistle that all Irish kids really get to know, he began to learn the cornet a piston, or cornopean, and that we have a picture of that here. He learned it from Patrick Keating, who was a very famous yet retired British military band leader. It was a quick study, I mean really quick study. And in fact, at 16, he completed his first published composition, Miss Enos Polka. So he was really an amazing guy. But he dreamed of far greater things, and his dreams took him to America. He lands in Boston, home of the Boston Massacre, the Boston Tea Party, and more importantly to him, freedom and liberty. He steps off the boat in Boston Harbor, October 16, 1849, as part of the first great tidal wave of the Irish coming to America. He promptly gets a job at Ordway's Music Store. It was the greatest hub of the musical world in America at that time. He starts gigging around town on the cornopean in various town bands, and he quickly becomes one of the top-notch cornopean players or cornet players around. In the fall of 1850, he's contacted by this guy, P.T. Barnum. Now, Barnum has heard that Gilmore has talent, drive, but more importantly, guts. Gilmore goes to work for Barnum, and he's promoting the first American tour of this gal, Jenny Lind, the Swedish Nightingale. Worked long hours contacting music publishers, newspapers, businesses, and the like. In the end, the first concert was a giant success, and Gilmore had gained the knowledge of promotion, a la Barnum, and he had contacts galore. Now began Gilmore's rise through the ranks. He was paying his dues, so to speak. He became the leader of the Suffolk Band and drilled them constantly to raise their level of performance. They played everywhere, political events, barn raisings, business openings. There were two guys standing on the side of the street, they'd play for him. You name it, they were there, and they were getting great press because of all the promotion that he had done. In 1853, he went to see Julian's band, came over from London on their first tour of the United States. At this performance, he hears a piece called Night Lullaby. It starts out really serene and calm, almost romantic. All of a sudden, it looks like there's fire coming from the ceiling. Down the aisles come firemen with axes and hoses. Just this big commotion, but the band keeps playing. Now they've switched from serene and calm to just frantic playing. It caused such a panic with the audience that ushers had to go down and they tell them, no, this is all part of the performance. Just sit back down, sit back. In the end, fire was out. Everyone joined in a rousing chorus of Old Hundred, even the firemen. People were amazed. Gilmore had an idea. Gilmore's next leadership post is the influential Salem Brass Band, whose name was changed coincidentally to Gilmore's Salem Brass Band. Lots of jobs of every kind and all over the local area. He was constantly searching for the best players, and after a while, they began to seek him out. In 1855, he started the Promenade Concerts. Now, those turned into the Boston Pops Concerts that we know today. Now, 1856 was a big year for him. Gilmore promoted the first 4th of July concert in Boston Common. It was a giant event, huge success. And since 1856 was an election year, he played at every rally for every candidate that year. Now, that was James Buchanan for the Democrats, John C. Fremont, the Pathfinder, for the Republicans, and Millard Fillmore for the Whigs. Buchanan was elected. He played at the inaugural. At the inaugural, his press reviews were absolutely over the moon. People just could not believe that a band would play like this. Further spread his name and fame. During this time, he was still composing. He had composed a piece called Good News from Home. It sold 100,000 copies. This made him big money in his day. He got married this year to Ellen O'Neill, good old Nellie. And, oh yeah, he changed his name. Now, Gilmore was baptized Patrick Stephen Gilmore. Now, people around him were telling him, you know, that's too Irish of a name. And you're losing bookings, so you need to change it somehow. Just do it. So he did. He changed it to Sarsfield. Now, Sarsfield was one of the greatest of all generals in the Irish army. So he still kept it in the family, so to speak. Now, he changed the instrumentation during this time period. Brass bands were just that. They were all brass instruments and some drums. He now added two woodwinds for every brass instrument. Okay, so bigger tone color. Now, he did this because he wanted to start playing classical music, more of it, to reach a broader audience. Okay, now this is what happened. This is the start of the modern, what we know today as the modern concert band. December 18th, 1856 is a pivotal time in not only band history, but cornet history. Gilmore plays a concert with the legendary Ned Kendall. Now, Ned Kendall was the greatest keyed bugle player of his time. He was a humble giant in his day, and he had a huge following. During the song, Wood Up Quick Step, they both took turns on the solo part. Back and forth they went, Kendall's followers cheering wildly after his stint, Gilmore's fans doing the same thing. Now, I want to give you just a little brief sidetrack here, so kind of bear with me. As you can see on the left is a keyed bugle, okay? And you'll notice that it has keys much like a saxophone. It lends itself to playing lyrical, rich melodies, but you really can't work up a lot of speed. On the right, okay, here's a cornet. It uses pistons that are enclosed, so the air column goes completely through the instrument. It doesn't escape in any way except out the bell. Okay, you can change pitch with this very quickly. If you've ever listened to the Carnival of Venice, you know, the Bohemian Krill variations, or Herbert L. Clark play it, you get the idea. Now, this was the passing of the keyed bugle. Kendall just couldn't display the technical brilliance that Gilmore did. And although the concert ended amicably, the cornet was the instrument of choice by the brass players. In 1860, Gilmore played for both the Democratic Convention, Stephen Douglas, and the Republican Convention, Abraham Lincoln. Lincoln was elected, and Gilmore's band played for the inaugural. And he played for it again in 1864. Now, Gilmore was really in demand. He was the go-to guy. Now he begins to bring men into the band that were legendary on their instruments. Edward Lefebvre on a new instrument, the saxophone. Lefebvre was the first superstar of the saxophone. And he brought this man, Matthew Arbuckle, to the band. Arbuckle was lured away from Fisk's band and remained with Gilmore's band for many years. He was one of the greatest and most admired cornet players of all time. Now, somehow Gilmore convinced the world's greatest cornet player, as he billed himself, Jules Levy, to join the band. Now, I have to tell you, Levy was a supreme pain in the butt. And he probably should have been called the world's greatest ego. Now, of course, there is going to be dissension about this, but there was an immediate dislike between Arbuckle and Levy. And Gilmore promoted this to the maximum to gain larger and larger crowds. I'll tell you a little story. Things kind of came to a head in 1879 one night. Somebody had told Levy that Arbuckle said, quote, he couldn't play a tin whistle, let alone a French cornet. And at the same time, somebody told Arbuckle that Levy had said that he was all wind and fireworks. He wasn't a musician. When they ran into each other in the theater that night, Arbuckle said, I could eat you alive. To which Levy countered, if you succeeded, it would be the only decent meal you had. As they were about to have what was euphemistically called fisticuffs, Gilmore stepped between them. And when he did this, he tore Levy's coat. Levy was enraged, absolutely enraged, and he challenged him to a duel to the death on the spot. Well, amused, Gilmore accepted. They made their way down to an arcade on Broadway, just a little short of 23rd Street in Boston. There, they would take each 6 shots at a target. Now, the loser would pay for a champagne dinner at Delmonico's for everybody in the assembled crowd. Well, Gilmore won by 1 shot, and someone described Levy as looking sort of like a deflated balloon. Gilmore and his band actually served in the Civil War. They were attached to the 24th Massachusetts Infantry. They saw action in Burnside's North Carolina campaign. Now, I have to tell you that just being in the band didn't mean you played jolly songs around the camp and then sat around while the fighting went on. When the fighting started, band members laid down their instruments and they were stretcher bearers, taking the wounded back from the lines. There's a report by the regimental surgeon telling of seeing Gilmore and Arbuckle under fire on the front lines at Tranter's Creek in June of 1862. So they were seeing the human wreckage that war costs. And this would influence him for a long time. The band was mustered out in 1862 and returned to Massachusetts. He ends up writing perhaps his most famous tune, When Johnny Comes Marching Home. Now you may notice that it's, who's it by? Lewis Lambert. He didn't want to put his name on there as being the composer because he didn't want it to seem too unionist or too southern. He wanted to strike a balance, be right down the middle, because after all, it's about selling music. In 1864, Gilmore is ordered. Now, he's been mustered out, but once you're in the Army, you're kind of always in the Army. He's ordered to plan the inauguration of Michael Hahn, and he was the newly elected governor of Louisiana. He was a carpetbagger. In Lafayette Square, Gilmore constructs a half-mile sweep of bleachers, holding 15,000. Performing was a band of 500 and a chorus made up of 5,000 school kids. Can you imagine? He's starting to show his genius. Let me tell you about the first number. Here's how it went. It's called Hail Columbia. The band played the first verse, 500. That alone ought to just blow your brains out. 5,000 kids come in on the second verse. The third verse, all the bells of New Orleans start ringing. How'd they time that? I don't have a clue. In the final verse, all of it all together, and you add 50 cannon and 50 anvils. Gilmore said it was an exhilarating din. And what about those anvils? Now, here they are. Here's the real reason, the Anvil Chorus from Il Trovatore. Now, Gilmore is just getting warmed up. In 1869, he would produce the National Peace Jubilee, his grandest idea yet. It had everything from soup to nuts. I have a little quote here from the New York Times. I never saw Boston when it did me so much good to be in Boston. For the reason of this very bonhomie, which I took in one and every breath, for once the barriers were down, we were all good fellows together. "Here's your only authentic program of the Peace Jubilee," shouted a fellow citizen sitting on a sharp-edged fence. "Let us have peace, ladies and gentlemen. Price, 5 cents. I have heard of peace at any price, but peace for 5 cents was irresistible, and I bought it. Now here's a seating plan for the Colosseum, as it was called. Take a good look at the left side, the left one-third of the plan. Now I want you to close your eyes. Imagine that you're in the middle of that section. You would be surrounded by 9,999 other people that were the biggest choir ever assembled. In front of you was the largest pipe organ ever constructed, and just beyond that was an orchestra of 1,000. The building was over 500 feet long by 300 feet wide, 86 feet tall. There were 1,300 feet of glass windows on rollers for ventilation. Along with 2 million feet of lumber, there were 15,000 tons of nails, 5 tons of ironwork, and 25,000 feet of gas pipe. There were 2,400 gas jets forming stars, triangles, crosses, and, oh yeah, there was an entire fire department engine hose company, complete with wagons, horses, and an engine inside. Plus it sat 50,000 people. The orchestra was led by J. Thomas Baldwin, who would later go on to form Baldwin's Cadet Band of Boston, and they made some of the earliest Brown Wax recordings. The choir was led by Dr. Evan Torsey. He was the director of the New England Conservatory of Music. Violin soloist was none other than the great Ole Bull. Oliver Wendell Holmes was commissioned to write the grand oratorio. And, wait for it, 100 anvils. He's gone up from 50, he's got 100 now. They were played by 100 firemen, all with 100-pound sledgehammers. On what else? The Anvil Chorus. Wouldn't you have liked to have been a fly on the wall during the first rehearsal? Garrity, would you mind playing on the beat with the others? 50 anvils on the left side, 50 anvils on the right side. What a spectacle. One reporter was overheard to say, "Gilmore can't be beaten on the anvils." And of course, when you're dealing with choirs of this size, you really need to have assistant conductors so that all 10,000 performers can sing together along with that organ and that 1,000-piece orchestra. Now, to communicate with these assistants, there were sound-powered voice tubes so instructions could be relayed from the bridge, as it were. And I imagine this to be something like this.
"A little more bass, if you please, Mr. Cohill."
Or,
"The tenors are rushing. Slow them down, for God's sake."
President Grant showed up the second day, along with his cabinet and a lot of dignitaries from Washington. Afterwards, when asked what he thought of the Jubilee, he said, "I don't know much about music, but I like the way the artillery was handled." On the last day, 20,000 school kids came to sing. Gilmore had to prove to the superintendent of schools that the building was safe. In the end, Gilmore made $7,000 in profit. Doesn't sound like much now, but it was pretty big back then. He was absolutely the most famous band leader in this country. Now, September of that year, the Colosseum blew down in a violent windstorm. It was a total loss. He continued to tour ever outward and throughout the land. He continued to write songs that sold in the thousands. Band increases in size. But that wasn't the only thing that increased in size. The word big had gripped Gilmore. It's sort of like, can you top this? Now, at the World's Peace Jubilee in 1872, there was a chorus of 20,000. Okay, so he's doubling everything. Well, if he could do 20,000 kids, 20,000 adults, easy. 2,000-piece orchestra. I mean, what's another 1,000, right? Just come on. Now, since this was the World Peace Jubilee, he went around and he got the Guard Republican Band from France to come. The Grenadier Guards from band from England came. The Grenadier Regiment Band of Kaiser Wilhelm came. The Irish National Band. The U.S. Marine Band came. Now, this was before Sousa, so about 8 years too early. And a band made up of musicians from the 26 largest cities in the country. And most amazingly, he got Johann Strauss Jr., the Waltz King, to come over from Vienna to play. They paid him $100,000 in that day. Amazing. It was the only time that he visited the U.S. 1873, Gilmore moves his family to New York. Everything is starting to move towards New York now as being the center of the musical world. He takes over the leadership of the 22nd Regiment Band. This was the leading group in New York, and it was something of a coup to actually get Gilmore to come over. There was one stipulation. It had to be called Gilmore's 22nd Regiment Band. They performed at the St. Louis Exhibition, had a standing engagement at Manhattan Beach Resort. They toured the U.S. and finally the world in 1878. He leased the old Hippodrome building in New York, converts it to Gilmore's Concert Gardens, held all sorts of concerts there. But in 1878, he didn't want to mess with it anymore, so he gave up his lease. Cornelius Vanderbilt's son sells it to a group of investors who names it Madison Square Garden. In 1886, he plays for the dedication of the Statue of Liberty. And in 1888, he started the tradition of playing New Year's celebration in Times Square. And we still do it to this day. December 17th, 1891, the band of 12 goes to the Edison Library and records 19 songs. Now, it is not definitively known that Gilmore was there. The logbook just says Gilmore's band, and then parentheses, 12 players. There is nothing, Gilmore wasn't a diarist. He wrote no account of this. There's nothing yet been found that I've found in musicians' diaries that might have been there. But just knowing how he was, I can't imagine him not being there. It's just the way he was. He was always in control. By now, time, hundreds of thousands of miles of travel in the most primitive of conditions, tens of thousands of concerts, close attention to the millions of details that made up his performances have taken their toll. He is tired. Yet in 1892, he takes on another tour. He takes his by now 100-piece band to the World's Columbian Exposition in Chicago. He gives a tremendous concert on the evening of September 23rd. It was absolutely amazing. People were enthralled. By about 2:30 in the morning, Mrs. Gilmore notices that he's up and about, moving around, just guesses that maybe something he ate is not agreeing with him. By 5 in the morning, the pain he is feeling is just overwhelming. Doctor is called. Nothing the doctor gives him any relief. By the afternoon, he slips into a delirium, and then a few minutes before 7 p.m. of that evening, he dies quietly with his wife and doctor in attendance. On the steps of the hotel, there's a small child waiting. When he gets the word, he turns to the assembled crowd, and there were thousands in the crowd. Gilmore is dead. People turn and quietly leave. 2 days later, September 26, 1892, John Philip Sousa's new Marine Band, as it was called, his professional band, he had left the Marine Corps July 4th of that year, it gave its first concert at Stillman Hall in Plainfield, New Jersey. As an affectionate tribute to Gilmore. Their first number was one of Gilmore's compositions called The Voice of a Departed Soul. It was the first premier concert of that number, and the torch had been passed. 14 members of Gilmore's band leave and join Sousa. They were viewed as traitors and shunned for the rest of their musical life by the other members of Gilmore's band. The band continued after Gilmore died into the early 1900s. They recorded for Columbia, and they were great recordings. The band asked D.W. Reeves of the American Band of Providence to take over and finish the 1892 tour. He led the band through 1893 and then returned to his conducting jobs at the American Band. This man, Victor Herbert, was asked to fill in, which he did, through 1895. Now, although Gilmore recordings are few in number, they nonetheless inspired many to follow in his footsteps. Several of his bandsmen went on to have bands of their own. Sousa and the others stand on Gilmore's shoulders. He blazed a path for them all to follow. Gilmore was, and still is, America's first superstar. Thank you.
Question time.
Yes.
Sorry.
There's a couple of rumors that I heard about Gilmore, which I wonder if you could clarify. One is that you showed pictures of him with all his medals on. They said that he actually made his own medal and put on his own thing, that his ego was so large to do that. And secondly, the association, somebody had mentioned that he had something to do with the writing of the battles of the Republic.
Okay, the medal thing. Not really true. It was the practice during that period of time when anybody would perform before large fraternal organizations and things like that, that a medal would be struck. And many of the medals that he had were struck by fraternal organizations as a gift. And so when you see that classic photograph of him with all those things there, he didn't really need to do it. he was too famous. Battle Hymn of the Republic, that's a confusion, I think. All my research indicates that he wasn't involved with really writing that. So, anybody? Yes, Seth. Sort of another kind of misnomer, that's another legendary thing that I think happens. Could be in his later years, because you know those last Victor recordings he made, he was sounding pretty tired. When you play cornet, you're pushing that mouthpiece against the teeth. Now, if it's just gum, the opening is much larger. And you're just not going to be able to play that. So I kind of discount that whole thing. It could be. I mean, he was a phenomenal performer.
Yes? I have a fairly vague idea that at that time, for example, they were playing at Lafayette Square in New Orleans, that brass band music was incredibly popular both in New Orleans and around the country.
Absolutely.
Gazebos and Park Squares.
Sure, absolutely. Brass band music was it. Of course, it came from the military tradition. Why wasn't concert band music played outside? Well, you really can't hear clarinets and saxophones and things like that outside. If it comes from the military tradition, it comes from bugles, you know? That's how formations moved. You know, they played a bugle call, the formation changed and moved into another thing. And that's really why brass bands were so popular. They came from the military.
Just because of the way the computer is going to change, we can't have any questions in between the two at the moment. We can have questions at the end. So
okay, cool.
Hang loose for about a minute or two, and then we'll get started. Yep.